Second half, I speak to the band Switchfoot, have a very lovely conversation with the lads. And first, there's Geico.
Do you own? Do you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
January 20th and 21st, the Adam Carolla crew is coming to Dallas, Texas.
If you've been on the cruise, look at this as a land yacht.
Working blue.
And what is the equivalent of a drunken cruise on land? Dallas, Texas.
That's right.
That's right.
With Adam Carolla and John Popper. Two days, tons of fun.
Live pod, all do stand-up, and we're going to do a screening of the K-Rock doc. John's going to do musical performances.
Oh, hell yeah.
If I'm doing my job, it's yours all that breaks, because the hook brings you back.
Your tickets for the package include hotel rooms, tickets to a live Adam Carolla show, brunch with John and Adam, a VIP meet and greet, a special screening of the K-Rock documentary.
And no seasickness.
No seasickness.
Probably some vomiting, but
yeah,
not a lot.
But it's your fault.
And of course, the big event on Saturday night, Adam Carolla and John Popper at Dallas Echo Music Hall.
Sounds really pretty. Beautiful place.
Working Blue with Adam Carolla and John Popper. Get your tickets now at adamcarolla.com.
Okay, the band Switchfoot has joined me in studio. John Foreman, Tim Foreman, and Chad Butler are all here. They have an album out. This is our Christmas album, and you can get it wherever you find finer music. Good to see you guys.
Hello, hello.
Hey, good to be here.
So Switchfoot, San Diego, surfing term, right? Switchfoot. Switchfoot sold 10 million albums? That's right. That's what I'm looking at. Over 26 years, and it's been together for 26 years uninterrupted.
Mm. Pretty amazing, especially considering two of us are brothers.
Yeah. God, I'm trying to think. Yeah, like Thanksgiving with my sister is probably enough, and, and that's a two-way street.
But that's every day with us.
Yeah.
Every day is Thanksgiving.
But so when you have a sibling, is it that you have the freedom to say things that you wouldn't normally say to folks that you weren't, that you didn't grow up with? Is that that part of it?
It is the, I think, the double-edged sword of honesty and history, right? Where you know that you're going to see this guy again, and so, but you also know that he's going to tell you the truth. You
That's
know?
Right.
Was music always in the cards growing up?
Yeah, I mean, so much so that I think we took it for granted. We just assumed that was normal to have instruments lying around the house. Our parents are both musicians, and not professionally, but we just had music all around growing up.
But music was never considered as an occupation.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. I love surfing, but I never thought I would be a pro surfer. Same thing with music, where you think, of course, I'll be a music, you know, freak for the rest of my life.
Yeah, were your parents geared that way too? Were they saying, well, it's good to play an instrument, like it's good to know a second language, but you're not going to be an ambassador?
Oh, my mom tried to talk me out of being a musician.
Yeah.
You know, my dad was in music for a little while and, you know, struggled to pay the bills doing that. And
yeah.
She was like, whatever you do, don't be a musician like your dad.
Well, it is interesting whether it's music or comedy, if you had, or radio or whatever, interpretive dance. If you have a parent that struggled trying to make a living in that profession, then you're going to have another parent and possibly that parent trying to talk you out of the thing they couldn't make a living at. It's a little bit narcissistic because it's sort of suggesting, if I couldn't do it, then what chance do you have?
Yeah. Or it's like, learn from my mistakes.
Right.
Don't do this, you know. Be better somehow than that.
Are we beyond that phase or that part of culture where the parent is going to somehow graph things onto kids? Like, I realized early I don't have any control over my kids. They're either going to be, you know, musicians or artists, or they're going to work for an insurance company, or they're going to sell fentanyl. Like I don't really get a vote.
Right.
And I don't know if you guys feel that way with your kids. I mean, I know the idea, you know, have a safe space, place for them to grow up and make sure they're hydrated. But like beyond that, can we push kids in a direction these days?
Man, I mean, I'm just thinking of like the surfing world down in San Diego. And I see for us, it was like we'd just get dropped off in the morning and, you know, picked up at night. And that was like our summertime, and I see a lot of these kids with like coaches,
right?
And like it feels like that's not just surfing; that's every sport where it feels like it's they've got a full time job by the time they're 12, and it's pitching or it's football or something like that.
What is the sidebar question? I started to put this theory together that people that spend a lot of time in the ocean don't have allergies and don't get sick as often and don't seem to be susceptible to COVID and things of that, like a general overall health, because their immune system is constantly fighting whatever's in the ocean, especially out here. Are you guys with me on that? Do you have peanut allergies? Do you have gluten allergies?
I subscribe to that 100%. I think saltwater cures everything.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm feeling like a little sick, I'll go surfing. Some people will be like, oh, no, when you're sick, you should stay away from the ocean. It's like,
and I was like, hey, man, that's pretty cool, because I've seen him buzzing up and down the coast over there in Malibu. And he was like, yeah, I've been on your show. And I was like, oh, yeah. But then I have to figure out what show and when and all that. But later on, he's an IMSA race car driver. I love cars, as you guys know. And he was just loading up, getting ready to launch off and take off just alone. There's nobody around. There's nobody on the beach. There's nobody in the water. He was just going to go take off. And do you guys have experience with those things? Do you own something like it?
Yes. So we were very early adopters of the foil surfboard back in down in San Diego.
Really?
When no one was doing it. So we didn't even know how to do it. We had some friends that had a few extra foils lying around. We had some old surfboards. We screwed them in. We didn't know what we were doing.
What year is this?
This was like
five years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of like within the surf community, it was becoming a thing. They weren't motorized, right? So you're catching a wave. And being lifelong surfers, you know, you think you know what you're doing because you've been on a surfboard your whole life. And so we didn't know how wildly dangerous they can be. I mean, it's like a broad sword attached to the bottom of your surfboard.
Right.
So you don't want to be catching the same waves necessarily that you'd be, especially learning.
Mm-hmm.
But we were. And then I ended up with staples in my head. Like, I think 8 staples, you know, just like the thing finally connected. And so now I respect the foil a lot more.
Yeah, because the broadsword you're speaking of is what connects the board to the foil, and it's got to be 24 inches, maybe.
Yeah, there's different heights.
Right in there.
They call it
and it's
mast.
Sharp, right, on one side so that it can cut through the water.
Yeah, right, and it's got to be stiff. I mean, it can't flex a lot.
Carbon fiber.
Right, so if you wipe out and something catches you, catches you, it's going to leave a mark.
Well, and the ones we had, I don't even think they were carbon fiber in those days. It's some sort of metal, right?
Aluminum mass.
So it was like heavy too. You know, there's some girth to it. They've come a long way. I think they've gotten safer, and now the e-foils, which we've done on tour, we borrowed some e-foils at a lake in Texas, and it was pretty amazing. I mean, you feel like a superhero. You know,
you are
Silver Surfer.
Yeah, I mean, you're skimming along 2 feet above the top of the ocean at 18 miles an hour. I don't know. I mean, you're moving along at a decent enough clip.
And that height feels a lot higher when you're doing it. You know,
yeah,
you feel like you're 5 feet over the water.
I'm always trying to wrap my mind around how one gets started. You must lay on your belly. You must get some movement going. And then at some point, you hop up, right? Is that how it works?
And the interesting thing about the mechanics is it wants to tip. It wants to flip. And
right.
So the entire time, you're flexing that front foot. Really a lot more weight than you would on a normal surfboard.
So good core stuff. And then and the other thing I think works for surfing that I've always drilled down on and no one really cares about, but balance. So balance is, you know, it's straight ahead balance. And then it's also kind of a metaphor. You know, people go, oh, you need that balance between work and family and blah, 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 leisure and whatever, you know. I've always been balance oriented. As a kid, it's just something that's in you. You find yourself walking on top of railings and putting your arms out and rode a unicycle my whole life. But I've always felt that balance practically had an application in life, like sort of spiritually, you know. And I don't know if you can speak to that or if you've even thought about balance, but having that balance that you engage out on the water on your surfboard for hours on end, and then you come in and then you have to make decisions and their business and their family and their professional or whatever, but the balance is engaged. And I know I sound a little kooky here, but does that ring true?
No, I think, you know, I mean, whenever you get surfers talking about this sort of thing, they sound a little kooky as well. But I mean, there is something to it. And kind of what I was getting at earlier, I think when, for me, that spot in the Pacific Ocean, when I'm, especially when it's a solid swell and I'm a little bit nervous. I think that there is a different part of my brain that's activated that puts all these other quote problems into perspective, you know.
And right.
I do think that balance. I mean, we joke around all the time, kind of kidding. That surfing is the reason why we're still a band, you know. The fact that we can argue about a song or an album and then paddle out and go surfing and remember that it has a context. That's huge.
Could you, now, most of the surfers I knew, you mentioned like a good swell. Most of the surfers I've worked with in construction and guys I knew, they were horrible students and bad employees because if there was a swell, they were all gone.
Right.
They just wouldn't show up because the swell might be few and far between and they didn't want to miss it. But you guys have parents that were pretty conservative and focused on scholastics and things like that. Were you truant a lot when the swell would roll in? What was the swell plan when you were like in the ninth grade?
Our parents were actually pretty cool. I think as long as we were getting decent grades, they, you know, like
big picture,
we would cut class to go surfing. And my mom would be like, well, you know, you're getting good grades. Like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. So they kind of gave us a long leash with stuff. I mean, there's a lot worse things that kids could be doing than skipping school to go surfing.
I completely agree. I just didn't know. I didn't know how married to the swell you were.
It is a funny thing because, I mean, there's so many things that take precedence in our lives, you know, that rightfully should, you know. There's an ambulance. We pull over to the side of the road. I mean, there's these things that in our culture we all know to give the right away. And it's interesting with surfing. It's not like a football field where it exists the same every day. It will change. It is changing now. In the next 15 minutes, going to change again. And so, I think with surfing, there's that feeling of like, yeah, no. This is the one time this year that this might happen. Might not happen for another 5 years.
Right.
But here we go. Let's enjoy it for what it is.
So shifting to music, Christmas album. Why Christmas album?
Well, it was a year unlike any year. I'm locked at home, 2020, and I'm trying to craft a Christmas playlist for my family. And I'm realizing that the album that I wanted didn't really exist, and so this was kind of the long game was let's be the Christmas album we want to see in the world.
Five covers, five original.
Yeah,
is that correct?
That's right.
Is when you sit down to write a Christmas song, do you just have 50 other Christmas songs in your head, or do you just try to go from a completely blank sheet of paper?
That's a really good question because it is a total, it's a different genre than what I do normally. Alternative music, you know, rock and roll, it's very, very different. And so for me, the two things that I really loved about focusing on Christmas songs, first of all, you're allowed a wider vocabulary musically. The chordal information on a Christmas song can be much more diverse than it in a, say, a, you know, Foo Fighters or Nirvana or rock and roll.
You get to use the expensive chords.
Yeah. And then I do think also what we were aiming for lyrically was to kind of – Christmas is one of my favorite times of year. It is beautiful. And yet it's problematic. There's a lot of different elements that for me, especially maybe as I get older, you're aware of this corporate capitalization. I mean, it's supposed to be celebrating gifts and what we have together, and yet it feels like there's all these different juxtapositions and paradoxes that are a part of Christmas. So what we were hoping to do with some of the songs is kind of dive into that and see, you know, not just happy clappy Christmas, but what about the problem of Christmas? What do we do with that?
Well, there's so many emotions available to you, right? That when you think of Christmas, your mind just goes on this wild spin of like good memories, bad memories. I mean, going as far back as your very earliest childhood memories.
Yes.
And so you get to dive into all of that.
Yeah, it's a good point, because if you are writing a song about a current breakup or a political situation or, you know, four dead in Ohio. Neil Young wasn't thinking about four dead in Ohio when he was 12, because the shit hadn't happened yet, you know. So everyone has this cache of memories from, you know, two or three on about Christmas. I just had this Christmas thought, which I've never had before, which is, I think you're having a good childhood, but you guys can tell me if this bodes true for you. My family, we were so poor, and I always wanted stuff, that Christmas for me was about trying to collect money and get something cool for a part for a BMX bike. That's all Christmas. It wasn't figgy pudding and old Saint Nick and, you know, stringing popcorn. It was just like, I got to get my shit so I can get some stuff.
This is my chance.
Here's my chance. I got an open window. My kids have a bunch of stuff and get a bunch of stuff. So for them, it's about all the accoutrements. It's about the music and the turkey and the travel and the snow. We're going to the snow and like that kind of stuff. But if your memories of Christmas are Christmas based versus stuff based, you probably had a better childhood than I did. But were your guys, did you grow up Christmas based or stuff based?
That's a good question. I think looking back, you know, our parents were very much trying to be like, yes, we're going to give gifts, but let's kind of celebrate grandma and grandpa while they're here with us. Like, focus on people rather than things. That was like, I mean, that's a tough order, because I've got a 4-year-old son, and, you know, he's like, yeah, grandma, grandpa, but, you know,
stuff.
What about this thing? Yeah, you'd like him. He loves cars. So I think that is the challenge for all of us. Like, how do we stay present to the people around us rather than these problems or the things that we're trying to achieve, you know? I don't know. I think they did a pretty good job of keeping our focus on people rather than the gifts.
Where are you guys at with it? It feels, you know, we have to switch the Christmas party to the holiday party because we want to be inclusive. And it feels like there's kind of a corporate attack on Christmas. That's all the Black Friday stuff or the whatever. Sorry, not Black Friday, but whatever, the day after sales that start 4 a.m. and people line up at the Target or whatever. Yeah. And then there's a kind of a spiritual societal attack, which is we don't want to call it this and we don't want to celebrate that. And this was something that was created by the white man and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I've always been like, first off, it ain't broke. Leave it alone. just keep walking. I we don't need to deconstruct everything that happened before you were born. You know, right. it just is. And then secondly, I know a lot of like Jews who love Christmas because they dig it. You know, they like the vibe. They like the music. They like the ornaments, you know, like everything, you know, like, I don't know, Cinco de Mayo, not Mexican, enjoy it. Good excuse to have a beer and a taco. Like, why the attack? And so I don't know if you guys have felt that or experienced that.
I mean, I think, yeah, there's so many different things you can celebrate in December. I think I don't know that I feel an attack. I definitely, the thing that I have a problem with sometimes, I think about, you know, Black Friday. It's an odd juxtaposition where yes. you have Thanksgiving, the day of the year that we are, you know, most outwardly thankful for the people and our houses and friendships and family and food. And
arguably the least commercial holiday.
Yeah, you can't really Hallmark it up. It's just like put a turkey in the oven, tofurkey if you're, you know, not eating meat, and just celebrate people. I think that might be my favorite holiday. And then the next day is like, we're going to the store. We're going to get everything. I just think it's such a great capsule of America in the 2020s where you say, on one day you say, this is the day we celebrate all that we have. We don't need anything else. And the next day is the biggest shopping day of the year.
Yeah, and it's not even at noon the next day. It's
no.
5 in the morning, and yeah. people are getting into fist fights over flat screen TVs. Like,
yes.
it goes. It's the antithesis of what Thanksgiving is, and it happens 12 and a half hours later.
It's mm-hmm. so funny. And I that actually was a song that I – that maybe for the next Christmas record we can kind of work it back to Thanksgiving. I think that would be a really funny song.
But, I think we love our juxtapositions as humans. Like there's something about people love, was it Fat Tuesday and Lent? Like the
right.
two, you know,
right.
like colliding
yeah, right.
two opposite things together.
Yeah. Well, I think we're that way in general because I do think about it musically. Like I always kind of discuss – I mean, in a way, it's like we went from Obama to Trump. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
could we get further apart? And it didn't take 6 elections. It was the next one, you know?
Right.
And then I always think musically, like I think, you know, in the early 70s, you know, you're talking about Neil Young and you're talking about folk singers and you're talking about songs sort of with a cause. You know,
yeah,
and it's an anti-Vietnam protest songs and so on and so forth, and that lasts for a while, and then disco kicks in,
yeah,
and then we all go, and and disco is 100% polar opposite than Neil Young,
yeah,
right? It's spandex yeah. and mirror balls and cocaine and you know singing about booging down, like it's literally it's nothing songs versus important anthem. Kind of songs. And then at some point, you know, hair bands come in and then grunge is the polar opposite of a hair band.
Yeah.
So it's like crazy hair band for the, you know, later 80s. And then, and by the way, disco gives way to punk rock.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
punk rock
right.
is the opposite of this. These didn't, you know, they didn't sort of dovetail. They went the opposite. There's nothing more opposite than disco, than punk rock. And then there's nothing more opposite than punk rock than hair bands. And then there's nothing more opposite
yeah.
the hair bands than Nirvana.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're reactionaries. You
I
know.
Think that's what it
yeah.
is.
Yeah, it's like trying to steer a boat, you know?
Yes.
It's like constant over correction.
Yeah, I think of it, I always think of the metaphor of if your dog grabs that sort of chew toy and you grab the other end of it and you start pulling one direction, your dog just pulls the other. But you can turn around and your dog will be pulling the direction you were pulling and you'll be pulling the direction. So do we have a direction or are we there to pull?
Yeah.
And maybe I think we're just there to pull, but I can't figure out where we're at now.
Well, I
musically.
Do think you're right, and I think that like Jungian archetypal if you think of a young kid, 18, you know, year old, any of us at 18, you want to fight something. You want to rebel. You want to challenge what is, because you see all the flaws. And maybe that – those are all the, you know, music makers, music listeners. Maybe that's what it is. It's more the age of where that comes from, you know, fighting what is wrong, what's broken.
Right. So now then the question is sort of where are we now? Mm. Like what are we fighting against? And I was talking about it the other day, which is to go back into the political realm. You know, we're in California. We're very blue here. And there's a lot of, you know, we're going to fight Trump here in California. But I've explained to many people, in California, Trump's not the man. Gavin Newsom's the man. Like the guy who's closing the beaches and closing the schoolyards and closing the businesses.
Yeah.
That's not Trump. That's Gavin Newsom. So if you're being consistent, you should be fighting him. You should be pushing back. He's the man. Push back against him. But comedians, artists, people, Hollywood people, nobody does. Right. So now we're in a weird era where they're going to push back against a guy who has no power over what's going on in California, but not push back against the guy who's, you know, declared an emergency order and has had it going strong for 3 years. So then why aren't you pushing back against him if he's now the de facto man?
We were talking about this the other day, that punk rock used to, it was the ethic in rock and roll in general. Even when we grew up, you know, just every band, the thought process was distrust any politician.
Right.
It was like, if you're a politician, I'm not sure that I trust you. That was just kind of the thought process with most musicians. And it is an interesting time where it feels like, you trust one color and you don't trust the other color, or you fight for one color and the other. Yeah. Interesting that it's come to that, you know?
Well, it used to be don't trust anyone over 30.
Yeah.
Now we have an 80-year-old president.
Right. Yeah. And now we're all over 30, right?
Yeah. Well, I didn't subscribe to that even back in the day, because I was like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Why should anyone trust me? I have no experience, no wisdom.
You had better foresight than I did. I thought I understood everything perfectly.
Interesting.
I'm 17 years old. I know it all.
Yeah, that is problematic, as they say. And it's something that's gone on. But have you guys changed then much? Because I'm fond of this because I want credit for it. Because the Duran song Wild Boys came on, which I hate, and it's from 1984, and I was explaining I hate this song, and then someone said, yeah, but I bet you were listening to it back in the day. And I said, no, I was not. I would listen to John Hyatt back in the day and Graham Parker and people like that. And everyone made fun of me because I didn't know what I was doing. But I was like, that I have not changed. I've listened to the same stuff. I like the same stuff. I mean, you get a little older, you evolve a little bit. But there is a problem with 17-year-olds thinking they know everything. And I got twins that are 16 and a half. So I'm living in the devil's den with that. But have you guys changed, or even changed like sonically, like were there bands, like who'd you love coming up, and do you still love them? And do you still kind of realize that their stuff holds up?
I mean, yeah. And I think the interesting thing, so for me, music was the medium to be honest, the way to kind of talk about things I couldn't talk about any other way. And I really admired people that had that honesty built in, even if I disagreed with what they were saying. I loved that part of music. And the interesting thing is, I think that is still where I'm coming from. You know, how do we get it at the root of this? I think song might be the closest line to get there, the direct root between this nebulous understanding of like, who am I? What do I think about this? I think song, I mean, you could be talking about God, girls, sex, anything. And I think the song is going to get you there faster. So many of the people that we listened to as kids were like just local San Diego musicians that, I mean, Boilermaker and Pinback and
oh, so you were into the
heavy
local
vegetable
scene.
And like, yeah, but all these were you bands listening no one had heard of
to like 91X when you were growing up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And they were playing the Pretenders or Nirvana or
yeah, like, I remember when Nirvana came on the scene. That was definitely Nirvana, Pearl Jam. Those were the bands that I thought, oh my gosh, this feels real. You know, you were talking about hairband earlier. Our neighbor across the street was really into hairbands, and I was like, I couldn't relate. It didn't feel right. But the grunge scene, when that first hit, I remember thinking, oh, this feels like something I can find myself in. You know?
Well, you know, I guess the question kind of comes down to with the hair bands, because I was the same way. I was like, these guys suck. Like, we have the Who. What do we need? What do we need Cinderella for? You know what I mean? And then also, I was always suspicious. Like, if you guys were good, then you wouldn't be wearing so much eyeliner and
right.
Aquanet. Like, you just go out like, Ben Folds is good. Ben yeah. Folds just walks out, sits down, mm-hmm. and is good. He doesn't have a whole bunch of pomp and circumstance. Most of the bands that are good just go out and be good. But so I was like, these guys suck, but I'm not sure why you guys are so into them. And then I felt the same way about fashion and architecture. Like, I'm like, I think many people are swayed by trends. It's not so much the sonic quality of the band. It's more like, this is what's going on now, and I want to be a part of what's going on now.
Mm. There's a phrase, every generation gets the music it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that apt for this conversation, where I think, I wonder, you know, what, I think back to the 80s, and you think, oh man, I wonder, you know, why, and then you think, okay, well, you've got some big corporations kind of divvying up what you're listening to. So maybe that's what we deserved back in the 80s, you know?
Yeah, people make fun of 80s music a lot of the time, but they're focusing on the Flock of Seagulls. Like, they're focusing on the sort of Bananarama mm-hmm. Flock of Seagulls 80s. But if you go back to Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson yeah. and Graham Parker and the Pretenders and those kinds of like early 80s bands, then you have some of the best music that was super raw and, you know, angry and visceral. And if you listen to like the first two Joe Jackson albums, like before he got melodic, it was just punk kind of, but pop, you know, mixed in. And then it just morphed into yeah. Bananarama somehow. And it's another thing. It's just like to go from, if you can find Chris, if you can find I'm the Man by Joe Jackson, which probably technically 79, maybe 80, it's like a punk, pop, angry, whatever. And then if you play Iran by Flock of Seagulls, it's a completely different thing that took place over like a 4.5 year period.
Yeah.
This is one of the best just straight ahead. He's literally like, it's so visceral, this song. At the end, he's just screaming. And he's so angry. Probably because he was gay and he couldn't say anything. Chad, I love the drums here yeah. because the drums are raw.
Yeah, yeah.
Some great fills.
I love the harmonica at the beginning, too.
Yeah. Oh, this is on the radio. Oh, we need I'm the Man, sorry. Oh, the album is I'm the Man, but more good drumming when I'm the Man comes in.
Reminds me a little of Stuart Copeland.
Yeah.
You know.
Although I don't know anything about drumming, but I'm not going to argue with a drummer. It reminds me of Stuart Copeland. That's my thing. I'm not... Oh, here comes the drum again. You guys know this one?
No.
Oh, he's going to get mad. And he's talking about corporatization of stuff. Like, I can sell you anything.
Huh. I'll speak to the masses of the media.
Saying, I'm the man and I can sell you anything. Yeah. And he's going to work the masses through the media.
Yeah.
Songs from 79.
Wow. So simple.
I mean, it's so basic, but there's a genius, like a good logo, you know?
Yeah. I mean, simplicity is always going to win.
It's such a straight line.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. We got to get to the end when he's screaming just because you guys are going to vibe out on it. Here comes the drumming.
That goes to double time. It's always the best, the end of the song. Yeah. This would be so good live.
Oh, yeah.
Like, tiny little club. Woo.
Hey, end a song, by
it's
the
killer.
Way.
That's a rhythm section.
Yeah, Joe Jackson was punk and like angry, and he got all sort of melodic later. But the fact that the beginning of the 80s was that, and the middle was Flock of Seagulls, and the end was Bananarama.
Yeah.
Took a turn.
And Cinderella. You know what I mean? Like, we're so...
It's a Cinderella story is what it is.
Yeah, but why? I keep trying to figure out now, then where now? Or are we too just scattered now to ever, like, capture a whole cultural movement?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it's one river, right? It's just like a bunch of tributaries.
And that, Bad Bunny.
Right. That's 10 minutes after Donna Summer, I'm the Man, by the way. That was the next, gave way to that movement.
Yeah.
But yeah, so maybe there's... You know, there used to be three channels and people watched them. Now there's 2,000 channels. Maybe we can't get everyone into the same tent.
Right.
Anymore.
There's never going to be the Beatles again, right? Like, it just, you can't. But I do think, like, it's been interesting to see over the course of our career, we've gone from big labels to the disintegration of the label and now it's Spotify and iTunes and. But now it's like, you know, maybe 10 people at Spotify that are picking the playlists. And it's just an interesting time to think, okay, well, what is it going to be next?
I think what's interesting, and I think it's a mostly good thing, is that, you know, growing up, there was like scenes. Like you're a punk rock kid. You're an emo kid. You're, you know, whatever it is.
When I was a kid, there was bikers and surfers.
Yeah. And now, it's at least musically, it seems like kids listen to everything, which I think is pretty cool.
Right.
That, you know, their playlist is kind of all over the map. They don't really pick one lane.
Even decades, it'll be like jumping from The Cure to something from yesterday.
Yeah.
You know.
But is there the opportunity anymore? And I don't want to lead you in one direction or another, but is it so saturated that some piece of art, could be comedy, could be music or whatever, can't just find its way out of pure quality? Right. Like, I feel like when I was growing up, if a song was just so good, it just couldn't be denied. It would just find its way, you know, float up to the surface, you know? Yeah. Now is everyone broken off in so many directions that there's killer stuff. Could be stand-up comedians we've never heard of doing a set about something that would blow our mind, or it could be a song from a band you've never heard of. Just like, oh my God, I didn't even know that was out there. Like, is that the era we're living in?
Well, I think that, I mean, the numbers on how many songs are released a day on the digital mediums, it's unreal. So I think it's pretty much impossible to keep up with that. But it still feels the same as like a mixtape in some ways, like a great song. You know, will get texted to you. And you say, "Oh man, you got to hear this," and that feels like the biggest compliment you could get is to have somebody say, "Hey, check this song out." You know.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Switchfoot right after this.
Lights on all the fake palm trees.
That is Switchfoot. That's off This Is Our Christmas album. And you can get it wherever you find finer music. And you got to pray one of these songs catches fire so you end up like Mariah Carey, right? So the band, you guys just got done playing the Ryman, which is a beautiful church theater in Nashville. I've played there before. It's beautiful. It's got the history. It's got the stained glass and everything. So for you guys, coming from your background, that's got to just be worlds collide, right?
Yeah, I mean, that place is legendary. You've got all your heroes have played there at some point, you know. And so it does feel like certain venues, Red Rocks, the Ryman, different places feel like they bring out the best in musicians. I think you saw Bright Eyes there, right, Tim?
Yeah, the Killers. I've seen a lot of great shows there, you know, days off in Nashville. And when you're playing there, I don't know if you felt this, it sounds so good in the room. You know, you feel like you can see everybody in the room. It's the right size, very communal experience. Probably, you know, you mentioned Red Rocks. Those are probably my two favorite venues to play.
Yeah, I just spent an hour in the Red Rocks Museum underneath Red Rocks.
Oh, it's so cool.
And it's just so cool going through all these bands. And it was actually nice because Blues Traveler was in the Red Rocks, you know, Hall of Fame. And I just called John Popper and I was like, "Hey, man, guess where I am?" I took a picture of it. But you know, there are bigger venues and there's soccer stadiums in Brazil and there's all the above. But I think if somebody was to take a series of photographs of you playing a venue at night and then have them to bequeath to your family, I think it would be at Red Rocks. Yeah. I mean, even though you could, it'd be awesome to be in front of 90,000 people in Argentina, but Red Rocks would still be a better photo album, right?
Yeah, and it feels like my advice to a music fan, if your band that you want to see on tour isn't come to your hometown, fly to Red Rocks and see them, because it will be a phenomenal show. I honestly, like, from a band standpoint, you walk onto that stage and you have done your homework extra. You're bringing something special to that night because it deserves it, you know?
How many times have you guys played Red Rocks?
Four?
Four times, yeah.
What a thrill.
Yeah, yeah, unbelievable.
It's like in a national park, I think, right?
There's no way they could have built that nowadays.
Yeah, well, it brings us to a subject, which is, if I remember reading the plaque on the side of the stone correctly, they built it after, I think, right around the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And so what they did is they just recruited a whole bunch of 15, 17, 18-year-old dudes who were going to get into trouble.
yeah.
and didn't have jobs and were destitute and said, come up here, live in this camp, work every day,
yeah.
and we'll feed you. And it, they created these sort of communities. And the people, the young guys were happy to have the gig because there wasn't, you know, they probably got paid $3 a day. And they dug a lot of it, began in 36, the construction. They, you know, a lot of stuff was just done by hand. It was just,
totally.
Just labor. But the bigger point is 18-year-old dudes who don't have anywhere to go need somewhere to go. They need to get physical. They need to engage. And they need to be tired at the end of the day and get up early the next day for more of the same. And when they show all these pictures, back then the guys were just Irish and Italian. And I keep thinking to myself, we need some version of that today, some sort of Job Corps or something. But we couldn't do it because it would like break down along racial lines or something, and some politician would get angry and then they'd accuse somebody of something. But we need some Job Corps version of that today for all the kids that are just walking around thinking about taking drugs.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I do think I'm thinking back to when we were 18, 19, 20, and our version was touring in a minivan. It was, you know, being exhausted at the end of the day, but feeling like, you know, we were on tour playing for no one across the country, but really thankful and loving what we were doing, you know, selling t-shirts and getting enough money for gas to get to the next town. That was our version. So, not quite manual labor, well, but
our mom, she sent me this neighborhood like directory that she found from back when we were in high school. And in the directory, it's got like, you know, people's addresses and that sort of thing. And then it had different jobs. So you could like hire Sally and Joe to babysit or whatever it was. And all the, you know, yard work, that sort of thing. And John and I had signed up for every job on there.
Really?
And we didn't know anything about it, but we pretended like we did. And we just, we you know, there's something about that at that age that, you know, rolling up your sleeves and digging irrigation for someone down the street and getting paid for it. It was like, it felt good. It was satisfying. You're learning something.
Yeah. Yeah. I think everyone now, way too many people ask questions about sort of the end game. You know, they want to know, well, why work at McDonald's? You're not going to own a McDonald's. You know, you don't want to be a McDonald's for 40 years. And I go, you just go there to work. You just learn how to work. You just work with other people. You learn how to get along. You learn what you don't want to do, which is work at McDonald's. And you put in a day and you get paid. And everyone wants to know, but your son, he wants to get into broadcasting. How's he going to open a radio station at the McDonald's? Like, no, he's just going to work. Yeah. That's all. There's something to it.
Yeah.
It's important. And by the way, it works. It's tried and true. It's a proven theory. You just go to work, learn how to work, learn what you don't want to do, put in the time, get the satisfaction. All the guys who built Red Rocks, they didn't open amphitheaters later on in their careers. They just learned how to work, which is a bizarre thing that I feel like I'm arguing with people with all the time. And then they do a lot of, well, you did that because you had to do it. And I go, yeah, but now I know how to work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what I do, which is interviewing you guys and others, doesn't feel like work because of building Red Rocks when I was 17.
I mean, washing dishes for the restaurant down the street when I was a kid definitely makes me thankful to have a job playing music. I mean, any bad day on tour, you're like, oh man, but this every day beats washing dishes at the restaurant down the street. I'll take it. The context, again, is crucial, right?
Well, you know, all you really have is context. If you think about it, you know, like there were times when you're on a phone call and it breaks up and you go, oh, please, what's going on in my world? It's like if you would have had that phone 40 years ago, you would have owned humanity. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You would have been the king of all you survey. But now you're bothered, you know, that it. So everything has a kind of a base and a context. We all know it through technology. And or just something like air conditioning. You know, it's would be the biggest thing in the world if you had that 75 years ago. So the context is the base. The base is work. And then once you dig the ditches or wash the dishes or whatever it is you're doing, then everything contextually is above that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But if you don't start off with a baseline, like you need to kind of set a base. If you don't set the base, then you could be doing what you want to do. Like
never know it.
Everyone who works at Twitter is miserable because they can't stay home and they're not getting fed for free. They don't have a base.
Yeah. Right.
You know, they have a context.
Yeah.
I think when we were first starting out, I mean, like John mentioned earlier, touring in a minivan, it's a great education and it teaches you the value of hard work. And I think about bands that never experience that suddenly get, you know, thrust into the limelight too soon.
Right.
They don't have that MO, that work ethic. And
yeah, like we used to spray paint our own t-shirts in the hotel late at night. That's what we'd do after the show to sell the next day to get gas money to get to the next town. And that was just what you did. And it was never a thought of like, oh, poor us, we have to do that. It was fun. It was enjoyable. It's like, dude, this is pretty punk rock. And it's such a different ethic to sit. Like when we were coming up, it was like, there was a pride in that where you said, oh no, they've been a band for a long time. This is their fourth record. They've toured, they've done their homework. And you kind of looked up to that. I think now, I don't know if that's still the case. It's kind of like, oh man, you fast forwarded it. You were on American Idol and you didn't have to do the hard work. And I think that's admired. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no one likes a try hard now.
Yeah,
back in the day, that was like, I think, you know, one of the higher honors is like, no, you worked for it.
Credibility is what we used to call it.
Well, you get the 10,000 hours in too,
yeah,
which is something that sometimes people fight against. You know, like I was a carpenter for many years, and I was talking about my son many years ago, and I hope he learns how to put wood together and be a carpenter. And this person said, well, maybe he'll be a better carpenter than you. And I said, no. She said, why not? I said, because I did it every day for 50 hours a week for over a decade. He can't do that.
Yeah.
He's going to muss around in the garage. He's going to watch some videos online. He's not driving a truck to a job site and rolling out at 7 in the morning and just doing it.
Right.
Like, and I didn't like doing it the whole time I was doing it. I wanted to do comedy. But the only reason I'm a good carpenter now is because I was forced to put in thousands of hours doing this. And, you know, the band that goes on American Idol and then gets signed and gets pushed out there doesn't really get that base. You're going to end up being Ty Pennington. It's a carpentry reference, but the point is, he's not a real carpenter.
It's a very niche reference.
He's a host. I mean, my point is you got to have that base. If you're
right.
You know what happens sometimes with comedians is they'll find some young woman who's like a hit and she's 26 and they go, you're going to host the late night show. And they give it to her and she flames out because she didn't have the years of touring. She didn't have the base, you know, the thing that we didn't want to do, we needed to do. And a lot of people don't have that base. They're avoiding that baseline.
You don't get the Beatles without them playing 6 hours a day in Hamburg.
I thought it was like 12.
Right. Yeah. For how many years? You know, a couple of years.
You guys, years? I always ask bands now if they have celebrity fans, like random celebrities we may have heard of that, I don't know, maybe it's Laird Hamilton. I don't know. But I mean, folks that have just showed up at your concert and you went, what the hell's he doing there? It sparked me when, oh God, who went to Green Day? It was, not Serena Williams. Yeah, Serena Williams. I was just watching one of my entertainment shows and Serena Williams is going nuts for Green Day. And I thought, that's odd, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I bet it would have been a surprise to Billy Joe and company if they found out Serena Williams is a big fan of you guys. But I don't. So now I ask any band that comes in here. Was there some surprise just out in the audience or coming backstage after a show or something like that?
Speaking of Green Day, they did this side project, the Foxborough Hot Tubs, and got invited to go to it and backstage. And Billy Joe is just the nicest guy. Just, you know, him, all three of them, just, oh, love your stuff, you know. And that was very, it's always flattering when you meet someone that likes your music, you know. I think the funniest story we have like that was here in LA.
Tommy Lee.
Yeah. We're up on stage and I looked side stage and there's this guy just going nuts.
This was early on too. This was like, you know, 2002, like, you know, things hadn't quite, you know, were just kind of beginning to happen for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was the first time playing like a 2000, you know, seat room. And there's this guy just freaking out. And it turns out it's Tommy Lee, like just singing along. So yeah, they're always really, you know, it's nice when somebody that you respect, you say, oh man, all right, we might be doing something right.
Yeah, and it's always interesting because I don't think there's any way the band would know in advance. That's just Tommy Lee wanting to go see. But I think people sometimes they don't understand that comedians or musicians or whatever, they're fans. You know what I mean? Just because they do it doesn't mean they don't want to see someone else do it.
We had the funniest one was, do you remember that guy? There was a guy in the front row that looked just like Michael McDonald. And so like we're in this.
You came from somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so we're like,
and we have these calm mics where we can talk to each other, right?
Like, oh, you do.
Like if because we never play our set list. We do a different set list every night. We always mix it up, and so it's like that way we can be like, hey, go to the bridge or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So in the calm mic, one of us says, I think that's Michael McDonald.
The intercom mic.
It just goes around.
We have in-ear monitors so we can hear each other. And we're all looking at him.
Does everyone have that, by the way?
Most people have in-ear monitors. And
but the comm mic.
We learned it from Dave Matthews, but I think a lot of people do. Mayer and, a bunch of people do. If you're playing live music on a big stage, it helps because you can actually be fluid and change things.
Right.
I've seen Questlove do an entire set where he's calling the shots in two mics. He's kind of talking to the crowd and then talking to the musicians in the other mic.
Wow.
But yeah, so this guy in the front, Michael McDonald, we're playing the whole set, kind of judging, seeing how he's liking it. He's into it. He's singing along. The end of the night, it's not Michael McDonald.
That's it. Salt and pepper guy with a beard.
Just an old dude who was digging the music. You know?
He just must have thought everyone was really just giving him a lot of eye contact throughout the night. You know, like, oh, he's nodding his head. He's digging it. He's into it.
Yeah. I love that guy's harmonies.
Amazing voice.
Yeah. I think his best for me is Peg with Steely Dan.
Huh.
You guys know that song?
No.
A lot of songs you guys don't know for a band, but that's because I'm old. If I'll play you, you'll know this one.
Oh, yeah, I know this one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
His harmony in this song is so strong. Can you picture him in this?
Yeah. This is, we did an entire tour where they checked the PA with this every day.
Oh, with Peg?
I probably heard this like 100 times.
I think it ruined Steely Dan for me.
Kind of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so it's like you got sick and your mom made you meatloaf and then you threw up and now it's 30 years later and you can't eat meatloaf even though meatloaf is good.
Yeah, we know it's good, but
maybe that's what drew the Michael McDonald impersonator to your show. Maybe he was walking by the venue and it was like the siren song of Michael McDonald and Peg just drew him into the venue.
It's me.
Alright, well, we'll hear him harmonize here.
Yeah, what a great harmony. Hey, we'll come back to you. Hey, the
yeah, because he's doing something there. Yeah. He's going up, and then he goes down, then he goes up again.
He's got such a sonorous, rich texture to his voice.
Well, that's why
well.
It loves you guys.
Oh, yeah.
He recognizes genius. All right. This is our Christmas album is the name of the album. Switch, what's the name of the band? And you can get it wherever you find finer music. We'll come back anytime, guys. This has been fun.
Yeah, let's go foil boarding.
Yeah, let's go foil boarding. John, Tim, Chad, thank you guys for showing up. I'll be in the Rialto Theater in Tucson coming up December 15th. And you can go to amcroll.com for all the live shows. And for dates, go to switchfoot.com. And until next time, this is Adam for John, Tim, and Chad. Say it. Mahalo.
Make sure you get a copy of Adam's new book, Everything Reminds Me of Something. It's available everywhere. Finer books are sold. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And get your tickets to see the Ace Man at adamcarolla.com.
You own, you rent your home? Sure you do. And it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling your policies with Geico. Geico makes it easy to bundle your homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing too, because you have so much to do already around your home. Why not make it easy? Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see just how much you could save. It's Geico easy. Visit geico.com today. That's geico.com.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in, watch free.